This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 13th, 2012. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, offering a variety of Westwood-grown annuals, perennials, and hanging baskets. Four locations in Northwest Arkansas. 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com.
RLT and the Second Stage Diversity Unites series presents The Rant, with performances this Friday through Sunday. An African-American teenager is fatally shot on his front porch in a crime-ridden neighborhood, and the grief-stricken mother accuses the police of murdering her son. 631-8988 or rogerslittletheater.org for tickets or more information.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, financial literacy for would-be entrepreneurs. Jacqueline Froelich explains how a new program helps small business startups. And as the Arkansas Razorback baseball team prepares for the College World Series this weekend, we consider the near disappearance of African-American baseball players in the state.
First, the May primary election is over in Arkansas after the counting of yesterday's runoff election votes. Democrats in Arkansas's 4th District selected Gene Jeffress to face Republican nominee Tom Cotton in November. Jeffress earned about 60% of the vote. In the 1st District, Democrats narrowly selected Scott Ellington to run against incumbent GOP Congressman Rick Crawford in the fall. The general election, November 6th, is 146 days away.
TheCityWire.com reports tourism tax receipts for Fort Smith and Van Buren are up. Hospitality tax collections for Fort Smith in May were over $60,000, an increase of 5% over May of 2011. In Van Buren, hospitality taxes were up more than 7% in May 2012 and over May 2011. An actor, playwright, and alumnus of the University of Arkansas will donate his papers to the university's Special Collections Department. Lawrence Luckinbill will formally give his papers to the University Library Monday during a week-long term as a McElroy Family Visiting Professor in Performing and Visual Arts. He graduated from the U of A in 1955 and has had a career on stage and in film. He was a Tony nominee for The Shadow Box and a recipient of the New York Critics Circle Award for The Memory Box. He'll also perform two of his one-person plays based on the lives of Clarence Darrow and Teddy Roosevelt during his time on campus.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals are now two games behind first-place Tulsa in the Texas League North Division standings. Last night, former Razorback pitcher Nick Schmidt pitched the Tulsa Drillers past the Nats 10-2 in a game played in Tulsa. The Arkansas primary election season is over. Runoff elections results were known by late last night. Now all attention can be directed toward the November general election. Roby Brock of Talk Business is keeping his eyes on what could happen between now and early November. Roby, thanks for taking a few minutes of your post-runoff result morning to talk about the election season.
You're welcome, Kyle. Good to be with you as always.
Well, first we'll talk about the runoffs. I mean, it was a very, very light ballot, especially Northwest Arkansas. But the Democratic Party did pick congressional nominees in the first and fourth. Any surprises there?
Well, there was a little bit of a surprise in that Clark Hall made a pretty strong late run, which was not expected. I think everybody felt that Scott Ellington, since he came so close to winning the nomination on May 22nd, would just kind of run away with it in the runoff. It really came down to some of the final boxes there, and I think the margin of victory for Ellington was a little less than 300 votes. So Ellington winning wasn't a surprise. How close it was, I think, was a surprise. And then in the 4th congressional district with Gene Jeffress winning the Democratic nomination, that was not a big surprise, his victory over Q. Byram Hurst. When you just looked at the geography of where the runoff races were going to occur yesterday on June 12th, it was clear that it was going to be to the benefit of Gene Jeffress. It was in areas that he's represented or his brothers represented for a little over a decade. So a lot of name ID in that part of the state.
Is there any reason to think in the next 120 days or so the Democratic Party in Arkansas can get a leg up on having a congressional seat in 2013?
That's a question that I think Democrats are going to be grappling with for some time. I mean, the 3rd district is not going to be very competitive because of just the way that that district was redrawn. It's become even more conservative, and it was already very solid GOP to begin with. The second district really tilts towards the GOP at this point in time, and Tim Griffin, the incumbent Republican, has raised over $1 million compared to his Democratic counterpart, Herb Rule, who has not raised much money at all. In the 4th District, Gene Jeffers seems determined to run the most unconventional, least modern-day campaign that one can run. His motto has been, I've got duct tape on my yellow school bus, and that's what's going to carry me to victory in November. And you just don't see him even trying to raise money to compete with Tom Cotton. I would say the 1st District is the one place where the Democrats will have a chance, but a lot of things are going to have to break right there. I think that Scott Ellington will be a formidable candidate in that he comes from the most populated part of that district up in the Jonesboro area, so he'll compete with Rick Crawford in his home base. But Rick Crawford really hasn't done a whole lot to make constituents that mad at him, so I don't think that they're dying to throw him out of office. And he is also has over $500,000 cash on hand in the bank, which is a big fundraising advantage over Ellington, who's basically broke at this point in time.
You mentioned money. Will money play at all a part in some of the interesting state legislative races as we wonder whether the GOP can gain control of one or both chambers in Little Rock?
I actually think that that might be where you see a lot more of the action this year. I think because the Democratic congressional field is as weak as it is, and the Republican incumbents, and then I throw Tom Cotton in there as the Republican front runner in the 4th, just have this overwhelming money advantage right now. And so I think that state Democrats, what matters more to them at this point in time, in my estimation, is control of the state capitol. And they are in danger of losing their slim majorities in the House and in the Senate. So I think that if their resources are limited, they are going to have to spend more money and place more emphasis on these, you know, real key battleground legislative district races. And that's where I think you may see them put a lot of money, a lot of resources, certainly a lot of energy and time.
Can we expect Governor Mike Beebe? I mean, he'll be going into the last 2 years of his job as governor because of term limits. Will we see him on the campaign trail?
I think that it's going to be critically important if Democrats want to hold their majorities for Governor Mike Beebe to treat this as if it is a referendum on him. He's not going to be on the ballot, but if Governor Mike Beebe, who is immensely popular, I mean, his approval ratings remain somewhere between 65% and the upper stratosphere of the planet. He has got to get out on the stump, and I mean visibly campaign with some of these legislative candidates, not only just raise money for them, but really stand up there in a very public way and tell voters of those specific districts, if you want to keep my brand of governing in place, you need to elect this person standing here right next to me and not his or her opponent. I think it's almost that critically important for the governor to be that visible on the campaign trail and make this a referendum about his governorship versus what the Republicans are going to try to do, which is tie all of these legislative candidates to a very unpopular President Obama and national Democratic Party policies. And an Arkansas Democrat and a Washington, D.C. Democrat are two very different animals.
Any other issues you think that will play out that will become important in the state legislative races?
Well, I think it will be interesting to watch if any of the initiatives that are out there trying to get on the ballot find their way onto the ballot.
Well,
and basically, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We've got till July 6th for signatures to be turned in.
Yes, yeah, so I think when we're going to know early on, I mean, there's an ethics reform initiative that has some bipartisan support. I tend to think that that might drive a little bit more Democratic turnout to the polls in terms of some people interested in that types of ethics reform. And you've got a couple of tax issues that are out there that might make the ballot, and that could drive some more conservative voters to the polls in opposition to those tax increases. And there's one that's guaranteed to be on the ballot no matter what. It's a legislative-referred initiative for a half-cent sales tax for the roads in Arkansas. I do think that that is going to automatically galvanize some conservative voters and encourage them to come to the polls, if for no other reason to vote against a tax increase. So think that's another reason why Democratic candidates may be already a little bit behind the eight ball.
Finally, anything that happens in November 2012 influence what will happen in the run-up to election 2014 in Arkansas?
Well, I do. I think so. I think that if you see the Republicans sweep all of the congressional offices in the state, I think that that gives them some momentum and certainly some encouragement to take on Senator Mark Pryor in 2014, who, you know, I think will be very vulnerable to a challenge just because of the national political climate and how that plays out with federal races in Arkansas. And then I think the other thing, too, is if the Republicans do manage to get a majority in either one or both chambers of the state capitol, that has the chance to really influence the dynamics of 2014, too, and it could cut both ways. It's a little bit like the dog chasing the car and catching the tailpipe. You know, they may, if they win, then they have to govern, and we may see some policies set forth that voters either respond very positively to or very negatively to, and then that could change the dynamics of the 2014 race, whereas you could have Democratic candidates say, see, we told you this would happen, or you could have Republicans proudly beating their chests and saying, we got into office and we did these things to the betterment of Arkansas. And so I think that the dynamics of what happens at the State House in 2012 could certainly influence the 2014 elections.
I have a friend who calls that the Roadrunner moment, when the coyote finally catches the Roadrunner. Now what?
Well, you know, and let's just hope that at the end of the day, the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote will go drink a beer after hours and maintain a little civility in their approach to government.
Hear, hear. Roby Rock covers business, politics, and the economy at TalkBusiness.net. He's the publisher of Talk Business as well. Roby, thank you.
Good to be with you, Kyle.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and director Lynn Shelton talks about her new film, Your Sister's Sister, starring Emily Blunt, Rosemary DeWitt, and Mark Duplass. She also directed the indie film Hump Day and the episode of Mad Men from season 4 in which Joan considers having an abortion. Join us.
Fresh Air this evening at 6, right after All Things Considered on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Tomorrow night, we'll bring a Fayetteville pork premiere. A leaping 6-foot-tall white pig will make its debut. The figure will become familiar, but with some modifications, over the next few months. The sculpture is part of an ambitious fundraising effort for Ozark Literacy Council. Roughly 24 copies of the pig will be sponsored, adapted by artists in their own vision, then auctioned off this fall. In between the design and the auction phases, the decorated pigs will be seen all over Fayetteville. Tomorrow night, the blank pig will be shown off for the first time at what's being called Ella's Pygmalion Preview Party at Ella's Restaurant at the Inn at Carnell Hall on the edge of the University of Arkansas campus. This sort of citywide animal-inspired public art installation began with a Cows on Parade in Zurich in 1998 and then became wildly popular in Chicago a year later when that city had its own Cows on Parade. During that Chicago exhibit, almost every corner turned in downtown revealed another artist's take on a bovine sculpture. Wendy Poole, the executive director of Ozark Literacy Council, says the desire here was to have the same kind of experience, just with pigs.
Absolutely. And we took all the research from every other city that has done this, and many cities have done this. But, you know, we couldn't do anything else except for a pig here.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, was there any discussion?
Nothing. Never, ever.
Not mosquitoes, not...
Nothing.
Okay.
No. We knew we had to do a pig, but we knew we also couldn't do a razorback because of the licensing problems there. So we went ahead with it. The board did their work, our board, Ozark Literacy Board. They made us do all the research and make sure that we could do it because we're a very small agency. We have a budget less than $150,000, and this is a big, costly project. So they gave us, after about 2 or 3 months of, you know, due diligence, we finally were given the okay, and so we started it last year.
There are 25 pigs up for sponsorship in Pigsibition. This past winter, after a call to area artists, there were more than 140 submissions for how to dress up a pig. Those artistic visions can be found in the portfolio online. The artist's ideas range from swine flew, that's spelled F-L-E-W, The pig has wings and an Air Force design. To the New Orleans-themed The Pig Easy.
That was the first sell, was selling it to the artists. This was a great idea that we could link literacy in Northwest Arkansas with the fantastic culture, artistic, local artistic community that we have. So we sold it well, I think. We had over 50 artists and three or four families that did it as projects. And we had submissions from Oklahoma City to all the way to Little Rock. And then, of course, we have some foreign countries involved as well because we have an international student population. So some of our students entered.
Potential patrons can sponsor an artist's work for $3,000 or $6,000. The higher donation means the finished pig remains yours forever. The $3,000 sponsored pigs will then be auctioned off in October to the highest bidders. So far, about half of the pigs have been claimed. Each artist selected receives a $500 honorarium upon completion of the pig. And the creative process doesn't have to stop there, according to Don Moore, a co-organizer of Pigsibition and board member of Ozark Literacy Council.
And then there's always another option, too, that we keep throwing in, that if this sponsor has someone who is one of his employees or one of his family who's artistic and wants to take on the challenge of doing the pig, we would welcome that, too. All they'd have to do is just submit their artwork to us and go through the committee, and we'd get that working pretty quick.
The first chance to see the blank pig, created by sculptor Mike Davis Gutierrez, will be tomorrow night. The 25 fiberglass molds are being produced by Glenn Samuels of Hinesville. Sponsors and artists will also be on hand for the Pygmalion preview. And that title for the kickoff should tell you there's an underlying theme here, puns and plays on words. During Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue, all of the pigs will be on display in the Pig Corral. The final auction is called Piggies Go to Market. Wendy Poole and Don Moore say artists and organizers alike have had fun bouncing ideas off of one another.
Everybody actually has really loved that. And especially at board meetings or committee meetings, you know, this has been going on forever. So we have come up with lots more that you don't even see on the paper.
Some of these designs are just out of this world. I mean, it's incredible some of the ideas that these artists have come up with to put on this pig. In fact, in some cases, turn the pig into another animal.
Like we have Edgar Allan Pork. And I don't have the book here, so I can't remember them all, but there are many, many artists use the pun.
One of our sponsors runs a local restaurant, and she chose a mermaid pig.
Well, I would assume then that's mermaids.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
Yes.
Wendy Poole, the executive director of the Ozark Literacy Council, says the project was helped along by involvement from the Fayetteville Advertising and Promotion Commission. And she says there's room for more. At least 12 more pigs can be sponsored, and more of the swine can be ready if there is demand. She says the mission for Pigsibition is threefold: promote the city of Fayetteville, provide a chance for artists to ham it up, and help the Ozark Literacy Council with its work.
We have a partner. We have the Advertising and Promotion Commission is our partner, and we partner with them, so we are promoting the information about literacy. We're promoting the local art in Fayetteville and promoting the city with this event. But yes, literacy in the state of Arkansas is there's a terrible, terrible quote. One out of five people read below a fifth grade level.
20%.
20% of the state reads below a fifth grade level. So, and we have two different students at Ozark Literacy. We have an international student, so somebody that is learning English literacy for the first time, or an advanced international student. And then we also have the student that is studying literacy because they just didn't do well in school, or they dropped out of school, or whatever reason it is, we teach everybody the same curriculum, and it works.
You can see the artist conception for the pigs at pigsibition.com. Just look for the link at the bottom left, or you can just go to the link at ozarksatlarge.com. The Ella's Pygmalion preview is tomorrow night at the Inn at Carnell Hall in Fayetteville from 6 until 8. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I bet it will not be a bore.
Oh, that's cool.
It will not be a bore. It will be a lot of fun.
Don, Wendy, thank you both very much.
Thanks. Thanks
thank
a lot.
You.
We got a new pig in the parlor. We got a new pig in the parlor, and he is Irish too. Right hand to your partner, left hand to the next one, right hand to the next one, and all promenade, and all promenade, and all promenade. Swing the lady behind you, and all promenade. We got a new pig in the parlor, we got a new pig in the parlor, we got a new pig in the parlor.
You can go to WikiHow, Google, or even your local library. But starting and succeeding at small business requires certain skills and insight. To that end, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Small Business Administration launched a new training curriculum for new and aspiring entrepreneurs. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The economic recession displaced nearly 7 million workers between 2007 and 2009, swelling job training centers and enrollment at community colleges. And some Americans sought job security by starting their own small business. According to one survey, more than 12% of Americans reported starting a business in 2011, up from 8% in 2010. That trend has slowed in 2012 as the marketplace falters due to concerns about the European debt crisis. And James Yeagley, Senior Community Affairs Specialist at the FDIC, via conference call with Acting Associate Director Luke Reynolds, said they want to help more Americans find success through the newly launched Money Smart for Small Business curriculum. James Yeagley.
We know that there are a lot of really strong resource providers out there who provide a lot of quality training. But a lot of the training and resources really geared towards they're more of a advanced curriculum. They're really geared towards complex businesses, and there isn't a lot that's introductory, and there really isn't a lot for people to get their foot in the door. And so the goal of Money Smart for Small Business really is to provide that overview of the basics of how to organize and operate a business. We know that there's a lot of people out there who are thinking about starting a business. They may already have started a business. You may, for instance, you can think of someone who's maybe a house painter, and they're great at their job. They're a great house painter. They know what to do, but they don't understand the operations of setting up a business. They don't understand legal or tax requirements, for instance, or someone who's a baker and they're opening up a bakery, and they know how to make great cupcakes, and they know how to actually sell that business, but they don't understand some of those other elements that go into organizing the business. So we wanted to make a training that was available to them, that was accessible. It's something that could give them those basics right away and maybe lead to some additional training down the road as well.
The financial literacy curriculum just launched will be made available through established existing financial institutions and small business development centers.
Organizations that have traditionally worked through the Small Business Administration, and there's a number of partners, and one type of partner is the Small Business Development Center. So their acronym is SBDC, and actually a good way for someone in Arkansas, if they're trying to find that local center near them, would be to look at, to type in SBDC as the acronym and search by that. Another organization is really just goes by the acronym SCORE, so that's been their name, and they're basically an organization that uses retired business persons to provide mentoring and training to small businesses. And there's a third set of partners, which are the Women's Business Centers, and their acronym, of course, is going to be WBC.
FDIC will also partner with community banks to provide training, as well as a nonprofit microenterprise sector.
And they traditionally work with very small businesses, and they provide training and technical support and lending as well. So a microenterprise typically is a one-person business, or they may have a second employee. And the micro lender is making a small amount of money, like a loan of $35,000 or a loan of $50,000. And it's something to get this venture started. And so there's networks of these organizations out there. So we're looking really to work with these microlenders as well. So if people are interested in finding a microlender in their community, it's something they can search. They can search just the term microlender or microfinance, and the odds are that they'll find an organization near them as well.
The FDIC will recognize select organizations that deliver the Money Smart for Small Business curriculum through the Money Smart Alliance program. potential alliance partners should be able to conduct and market the training in their community, and they should be able to provide follow-up training, referrals, or technical support to graduates of this training. Luke Reynolds said the Money Smart for Small Business curriculum contains 10 training modules.
The modules in the Money Smart for Small Business curriculum were developed based upon focus groups talking to those who advise and work with small businesses to understand the key topics that we needed to present the basics of to entrepreneurs and prospective entrepreneurs in one-hour workshop sessions. So the modules range from a basic overview of how to use services from an insured financial institution effectively, up through topics such as record keeping, financial management, managing risks and insurance, selling a small business, planning for succession, and organizational types and considerations.
New curriculum is part of FDIC's existing Money Smart program, a financial education program for low to moderate income Americans.
The FDIC Money Smart program was launched a little over 10 years ago, and in the 10 years since it's released, we facilitated reaching over 2.75 million consumers with financial education. The Money Smart curriculum is designed for those who don't have a bank account or may have a bank account but want to learn more how to manage their finances more effectively. We have versions available for instructors to teach both adults and young adults, as well as versions for consumers to complete at their own pace using the computer or listening through audio. The Money Smart curriculum is available in 9 languages, and we have research, and research has shown that the Money Smart curriculum, when delivered in an instructor-led format, can be effective in driving sustainable behavior changes, positive behavior changes in how consumers manage their finances.
But again, the Money Smart for Small Business curriculum will be delivered via instructor, who will use scripts, our participant guide, and slides. And although there's always some risk starting up your own business, programs like this help new owners to understand and weigh that risk.
While, as James mentioned, as many small business owners are well-versed in the technical and procedure aspects of their business, they often lack a good understanding of the financial aspects, and it results in the business, and many times failing, and in harm to both the consumer, both, of course, to the business, but then also to the consumer. So, I mean, I think this curriculum, there's growing interest in small business and entrepreneurship as a vehicle for job creation, as a vehicle for recovery. And starting a small business isn't something to be taken lightly. Before a person starts a small business, they really need to take time to make sure that they understand the decision that they're making, and particularly before they make any financial decisions, and make sure that they have a business plan, and that the business plan is reasonable. And for those who may need assistance or may need help thinking through these issues, the SBA has a strong network of resource partners that entrepreneurs or prospective entrepreneurs can find through visiting the SBA's website. They can go to the SBA's website and find local resource partners that can help them determine whether starting a small business is the right thing to do now, or if so, and then some of the next steps to take.
And certain businesses are considered more recession-proof than others. For example, senior and home care services, health and wellness services, warehousing, shipping and logistics, and office temp providers. And if you're adept with devices, you could get really lucky. Inc.com cites the top 10 startups worth watching include Pinterest, an invite-only social discovery platform, TaskRabbit, an online task-for-pay platform, and Birchbox, which sends monthly beauty samples to those who sign up, a concept that Walmart recently announced it plans to replicate with grocery samples. Plus, more banks are loaning to small startups, as of late last year as much as $20 billion over the next 3 years, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like to know more, you can go to fdic.gov/moneysmart.
Ahead on Ozarks, a quick survey of the rosters of the teams in this weekend's College World Series reveals that the game has had a difficult time attracting young African Americans.
Kind of asking him about, does he see himself as an exception? Yes, he does. Is it something that he talks about with his white and black friends? Yes, certainly is. He said he is made fun of by African-American friends occasionally. I don't think it's serious. They just josh around with them.
Evan Day Morrell is an Arkansas-based freelance writer, and he's been researching why a game that was once popular with young people of all colors has fewer African-Americans playing now. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
It's Wednesday the 13th. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Becca Martin-Brown, for the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, with us again.
We're going to have a little road trip segment.
What to do outside of our region.
And Kevin Kinder, our music writer, recommends a band called LMFAO.
Right.
If you don't know what that means, I'm not going to tell you on the air. They came into mainstream success when they performed with Madonna at the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a mega hit called Party Rock Anthem. They'll play tonight at the BOK Center in Tulsa and Friday at the American Airlines Center in Dallas. And you can find out more at LMFAOmusic.com. Also, if you're headed for Dallas, Coldplay is there at the American Airlines Center, the 22nd and 23rd. Buddy Guy is at the Verizon Theater at Grand Prairie on the 23rd. ZZ Top is at the Gexa Energy Pavilion on the 24th. And the Scorpions are at the Verizon Theater at Grand Prairie on the 27th. If that doesn't cover the music you like, I give up.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
150 years ago, Union General Samuel Curtis was having trouble supplying his Army of the Southwest through a tenuous supply line from Missouri to Arkansas. He requested supplies via the White River, and on June 13, 1862, a flotilla of Union gunboats set out from Memphis to answer his call. Confederate Navy Captain Joseph Fry, meanwhile, scuttled his gunboat, the Maurepas, and two steamboats to block the river at St. Charles as he built gun emplacements on the high ground there to contest the Union vessel's passage. Aided by sailors from the Confederate gunboat Poncher Train, Fry sighted his mass batteries on the river, setting the stage for what has been called the single deadliest shot of the Civil War. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
KUAF is supported by Ozark Natural Foods, Northwest Arkansas's consumer-owned food co-op since 1971, offering local organic produce and all-natural groceries, bulk foods, health and wellness products, and a full-service deli. Ozark Natural Foods is located in the Evelyn Hills Shopping Center or on the web at ozarknaturalfoods.com. Support for KUAF comes from Creekfest Summer Event Series, located at Village on the Creeks in Rogers. This family-friendly event is free and includes a variety of entertainment each Thursday throughout the summer. Creekfest welcomes Kalen Cripps Band this Thursday at 7 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. Creekfest.net for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team will open play in the College World Series Saturday afternoon against Kent State. If you look at the Razorback team photo or the Kent State team photo or any of the eight teams that qualified, you'll see predominantly white faces. African-American participation in college baseball is low, very low. That hasn't always been the case. When the 1985 Razorback team went to the College World Series, five of the team's starting players were African-American. This change has attracted the attention of freelance writer Evan Day Morrell. His examination of the diminishing number of African-Americans playing baseball in Arkansas appears in Arkansas Life magazine, and a version of the article was in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette this past Sunday. This week, Evan Day Morrell talked about the article from his home in Little Rock and about the reasons for the low participation of African Americans in the national pastime.
It's a complicated question, and just for the sake of the article, which originally ran Arkansas Life magazine, there's an expanded version of the article in that magazine, and the one that was in the Sunday's Perspective section in the Democrat Gazette, is a little shorter and it's updated. I was able to go and talk to Devon McClure, an Arkansas baseball signee, really one of the few African Americans in recent years to sign with Arkansas, who may actually not end up playing there. He may end up playing with the Cleveland Indians, who just drafted him. And I talked to him, got an update. But yeah, I mean the reasons. Just trying to focus on college baseball in Arkansas. A big reason at that level would be college scholarships. You know, the college baseball players, you can have 25, 35 players on a team typically, and there's 11.7 scholarships that most of the players aren't getting full scholarships. They're getting partials. Whereas in football and baseball, almost all the players are getting full scholarships, especially in basketball, almost all of them are getting full scholarships, and most are in football get full scholarships. So at a certain level, it becomes economic at that level. If you go back to younger ages, you start getting into more cultural reasons at this point or social reasons. That's kind of where it starts.
Do we have these small numbers of African-Americans playing baseball when you get to the American Legion, Babe Ruth, or Little League levels?
Gosh, Kyle, good question. You know, honestly, I did not play baseball growing up, and that's probably one of the reasons that I guess maybe approach this as an outsider. I mean, I'm not African American. I'm white. But you know, growing up, I did not play in those American Legion, those youth baseball leagues. I was a big basketball guy, some soccer. But kind of looking on at the outside, I even in the 90s, you know, it was almost all the white people at my school in the Heights, in Little Rock. The players that made up these teams were mostly white, and just anecdotally, like talking to people for this article, I kind of confirmed what I thought is you just look at American Legion, look at Babe Ruth, Junior Deputy. Now there's definitely exceptions. Some places like still in Pine Bluff, still some teams in Maumelle, for instance, even in Bryant. You do have exceptions occasionally, but the trend the last few decades is increasingly white color.
Well, I wonder how much of this is a general baseball problem, in that you can drive around almost any community in the state on a warm day and you can find a pickup basketball game between guys who are in their 40s, kids who are teenagers, and everything in between. I see pickup soccer, if not games, at least soccer practices or whatever. I don't know if there has been a pickup baseball game in this state or this country in the last 25 or 30 years.
That's a great question. I mean, you talk about, and this was actually a quote that was in the original Arkansas Life magazine article. It wasn't in the paper, but I really thought it brought it home. It's by a guy named Richard Lapchick, who directs something called the Institute of Diversity and Ethics in Sport out of Florida. He said, if baseball is going to be seen as the national pastime, you would hope it would reflect the diversity of the country. I mean, it truly was a demotic sport, decades ago in the early 1900s and 50s, because it was a sandlot grassroots sport. I mean, kids just played it, whether it was organized or not. And, you don't see that. And maybe part of that is, again, the money it takes. The other part of it is you just don't even see them playing stickball in the streets. That wouldn't take any money, but instead they're going to be playing other. In fact, they're not even playing sports as much outside anymore. You have more than staying indoors and playing, you know, doing indoor stuff. But if they are going outside, it's these other sports. Something I forgot to mention was I did go up to Fayetteville to talk to D.J. Baxendale, you know, for the story, the Arkansas pitcher, and I kind of just went out to Walker Park over there.
You can drive around almost any community in the state on a warm day, and you can find a pickup basketball game between guys who are in their 40s, kids who are teenagers, and everything in between. I see pickup soccer, if not games, at least soccer practices or whatever. I don't know if there has been a pickup baseball game in this state or this country in the last 25 or 30 years.
That's a great question. I mean, you talk about, and this was actually a quote that was in the original Arkansas Life magazine article. It wasn't in the paper, but I really thought it brought it home. It's by a guy named Richard Lapchick, who directs something called the Institute of Diversity and Ethics in Sport out of Florida. He said, if baseball is going to be seen as the national pastime, you would hope it would reflect the diversity of the country. I mean, it truly was a demotic sport, decades ago in the early 1900s and 50s, because it was a fanlock grassroots sport. Kids just fight it, whether it was organized or not. And you don't see that. And maybe part of that is, again, the money it takes. The other part of it is you just don't even see them playing stickball in the streets. That wouldn't take any money, but instead they're going to be playing other. In fact, they're not even playing sports as much outside anymore. If you have more than staying indoors and playing, doing indoor stuff. But if they are going outside, it's these other sports.
You did mention that you talked to Devon McClure, who has committed to the University of Arkansas, but was drafted in the fourth round by the Cleveland Indians. And for those who don't know, he could sign and go pro and not play baseball. What did you and Devon McClure talk about?
Well, we talked about, how cognizant is Devon of being the exception? And Jacksonville High is a little different insofar as their team, they've had a really good team recently. Last year they won the state championship. Has like maybe 5 to 7 players who are African American on the team, which is higher than most of the other high schools in the area, maybe outside of Jefferson County or some of the other Delta towns. So I was kind of asking him about, did he see himself as an exception? Yes, he does. Is it something that he talks about with his white and black friends? Yes, certainly is. He said he is made fun of by African-American friends occasionally. I don't think it's serious. They just josh around with him. But, he's also a football player. So he's a guy who he's going against the trend of specialization in youth sports, too, by playing, like continuing to play football and baseball through high school. And if you're going to see African-American players in higher levels of high school and then in college baseball, they tend to play football as their other sport and not basketball, which makes sense considering the seasons. I mean, football's in fall, baseball's in spring, so that kind of makes sense. But something I wasn't able to put in an article, but I thought was really interesting was, I think it was the 2009 College World Series team at LSU that won the championship.
Mm-hmm.
They had 2 African-American players, but both of them were on college football scholarships. They chose to play baseball. So you kind of see a little bit of a mini trend along those lines. You rarely see white or black basketball and baseball. But yeah, Devon is very much aware of what's going on. At the same time, he doesn't want to make it like a big race thing. He just loves the game. I mean, he's ready to go out there, make a name for himself. If he does see himself as a potential role model for all young people, but especially African Americans, it's something that he kind of, I think he's excited about the possibility of reigniting interest among African Americans, maybe on a local level, and then if he becomes a big enough star, big enough name on a wider level.
You talked to Norm DeBrine, the longtime head coach at the University of Arkansas, and I'm not going to get the quote quite right. I don't have it here in front of me, but he said one thing that he has disliked seeing happen to baseball is it has become, for lack of a better term, a white middle-class sport, at least with youth. And he mm-hmm. thinks that's unhealthy for the game on a national level.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the question is, if we think of baseball as our national pastime, I mean shouldn't it reflect the diversity of our nation? And that's something that it gets very tricky because it's something I was talking to DJ Baxendale about. And DJ is a white baseball pitcher for the Razorbacks, and that team right now for the Razorbacks that's kind of pounding on the door going to the College World Series is all white. But I asked him, is that something that you think about or talk about that much? He said no, because where he comes from, and he's bounced around the state, but where he came from in high school was around Sherwood in central Arkansas and North Little Rock, that area. And he's played with a few good African-American players, including Devon McClure, growing up. So to him, he's seen that at that level. And then when he looks ahead at the Major League Baseball, he sees plenty of dark-skinned players, black-skinned players, but they're Dominican,
mm-hmm.
not African-American. And so, maybe if he thinks about it, it registers that they're not African-American, but just as a quick glance, not something that he thinks much about.
Let me play devil's advocate and say perhaps this is not as big a deal as you and I are talking about. baseball is on the major league level, and certainly if you go see the minor league Naturals in Springdale, you do see a lot of white players, but you see a lot of Dominican and Venezuelan, and you see a lot of Asian-born or players with Asian heritage. So there is still this sort of rainbow or this diversity. It's just that African-Americans don't make up as big a percentage as they used to. And so maybe that's an evolution of a sport?
I mean, it's a great point. I mean, one thing that really surprised me looking back at this, again, because I'm not a sports guy, but I'm not a big, huge baseball guy, but looking back at it primarily through a book, which I recommend highly to anybody interested in the history of baseball and racial studies. It's called Raceball. Just came out a few months ago. It's by a University of Pittsburgh professor named Rob Ruck, R-U-C-K, How the Major Leagues Colonized the Black and Latin Game. Hmm. And, you know, that Hispanic influence has been a part of Major League Baseball really dating back to the 1870s. Even at that point, you had Americans would go down to Cuba, or the Cubans would come up to America and play in winter ball leagues and travel on traveling teams. And they were coming through Arkansas like as early as like the 1910s. Some of the Cuban all-stars. So that's definitely that part. If you just take it as a whole, the Hispanics, not the Dominicans, but the Cubans, it's been around a long time. The Asian influx is newer in America. But yeah, I mean, you have a point. I mean, there is a evolving kaleidoscope here. But at the same time, you know, I just think this is something where you look at the changing spectrum here, the changing face of baseball, and it matters because not only we have to kind of rethink what is our national pastime and what does that mean to us as a people and how should we define that, but also just the way the youth sports has changed. I mean, that youth sports in and of itself, kind of a separate subject, but there's a lot of crossover here. Kids just specialize so much earlier now, and they're really putting they're not playing the different sports like they used to. When they were, and I'm kind of getting off track a little bit here, but I started thinking about this as I went deeper into it, and I was thinking, you know, I'm 30 years old, and if there were kids growing up my age, a little older, like African Americans who didn't play baseball when they were kids, have no connection to the sport, and now they're coaching basketball or football or whatever, what impetus or what motivation do they have to be interested in the sport or to, you know, allow their kid, their players to go and play it? I mean, that you're really losing that connection.
Evan, thanks so much for your time.
Kyle, I appreciate talking to you.
Evan DeMorel is a freelance writer based in Little Rock. His article, Vanishing Point, about the declining African-American baseball participation, can be found at the website arkansaslife.com. A version of his story also appeared this past Sunday in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. If you'd like to read more of his stories about sports and life, you can go to the website thesportseer.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 13th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of Dorothy L. Sayers, born in Oxford, 1893. She was one of the first women to graduate from Oxford with a degree in medieval literature. Her first two books were volumes of poetry, then her first mystery novel, Whose Body, 1923, featuring Lord Peter Wimsey, a witty aristocrat who solved mysteries as a hobby. She wrote 11 more novels featuring Lord Peter. It's the birthday of the novelist and diarist Frances Burney, born in Norfolk, England, 1752. She started keeping a diary when she was 16 years old and kept it up for over 70 years. Her father had some famous friends, so she wrote about them: Dr. Johnson, James Boswell, David Garrick, Sir Joshua Reynolds. She was a lady-in-waiting at the court of King George III and Queen Charlotte, so she wrote about the madness of the king She married a French general, Alexandre d'Arblay, and thanks to him, she got a close look at the Battle of Waterloo and wrote about that. She also wrote about her own mastectomy, performed without any anesthesia except a single glass of wine. Her first published novel, Evelina, or The History of a Young Lady's Entrance into the World, 1778, A Comedy of Manners, was a great success, and she succeeded in making novel writing an acceptable thing for women to do and inspired Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, which came along about 25 years later. It's the birthday of Yeats, William Butler Yeats, born in Dublin, 1865. He grew up in a Protestant family at a time when Ireland was an English colony. Most members of the Irish Protestant upper class were pro-British, but Yeats didn't care about politics. He cared about poetry. He fell in love with a beautiful actress named Maud Gonne, who spoke out for Irish nationalism. She became the love of his life, and it was Maud Gonne who inspired Yeats to try to use his writing as a force for national unity. He came to believe that if he could get in touch with the deep mythic history of the Irish people, he could pull the country together with poetry. He spent years writing plays about Irish nationalism for Maud Gonne, but she married somebody else and he gave up trying to win her love, gave up on the idea of writing poetry for the collective soul of Ireland, wrote poetry for himself. And about the same time that he stopped trying to use poetry as a political force, he started getting involved in politics and served for 6 years in the Irish Senate. Here's a poem for today by Dana Gioia entitled Majority. Now you'd be three, I said to myself, seeing a child born the same summer as you. Now you'd be six or seven or ten. I watched you grow in foreign bodies, leaping into a pool, all laughter or frowning over a keyboard, but mostly just standing taller each time. How splendid your most mundane action seemed in these joyful proxies. I often held back tears. Now you are 21. Finally, it makes sense that you have moved away into your own afterlife. Majority, a poem by Dana Gioia, from Pity the Beautiful, published by Grey Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Barnes & Noble, maker of Nook Simple Touch with Glow Light, designed for reading with the lights on or off, available at Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is proud to co-sponsor Walton Arts Center's Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, with the Chamber Music Series. From this Thursday through June 21st, classical trios, quartets, and quintets will perform at various locations, including Thorn Crown Chapel in Eureka Springs, Cooper Chapel in Bella Vista, St. Paul's Church in Fayetteville. More information at artispherefestival.org.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Hawkeye.
Hawkeye. Nice. See what you did there? last night, got a quick preview of The Rant.
Yes.
The second stage series from Rogers Little Theater. I'll have a report on that in the next couple of days on Ozarks.
Excellent.
And
that's coming up soon.
It opens Friday night.
Is it Friday? Okay. It's
just a one weekend thing, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Also, tomorrow, something about the new play showcase that Boar's Head Players at the University of Arkansas are putting together.
Yep, do that every summer.
That's right. So we'll have those stories coming up in the next couple of days. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ithi and I together tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition. You and I back together on Friday.
Yes, have a good day.